My name's Rachel.
And I'm Neil.
And today we bring you the story of the Pottery Cottage murders.
So I heard about this case as a child, well, as a teenager. I remember my granddad talking about it. It must have been one of the anniversaries of the events, you know, in the local paper. But I distinctly remember him talking about it, my granddad and my dad. So it occurred in the Derbyshire Peak District, and from where myself and Rachel live now, it's probably 5 miles away. So we go back to Wednesday, January the 12th, 1977, and Derbyshire, or this area, was experiencing the worst snow in 15 years, apparently. Now, we know the area where these events occurred. Now, I had to drive up, actually, a couple of days ago, and it's kind of very bleak, lonely, and even in summertime, it's, you know, it's a very sort of isolated place. It's predominantly moorland where the pottery cottages are, and with extensions, and it's, you know, it's slightly altered, but it still stands today.
Billy Hughes was 30 years old at the time and was originally from Preston, Lancashire. He had a daughter who was living with his estranged ex-wife in Blackpool. Hughes was first in court at the age of 14 for theft, and by 1977, he had spent half of his life in jail. He was a physically imposing man and spent most of his days in jail bodybuilding. As time went on, he was convicted of increasingly violent offences. One particularly unsavoury incident resulted in him killing two police dogs with his bare hands after resisting arrest.
At the time of the incident, Hughes was on remand awaiting trial in Leicester Prison for stabbing someone in the face and rape at knife point. He'd been living in Chesterfield for some time before the alleged offence. Hughes was classed as a low-risk prisoner, not being a danger to others. This was despite 4 convictions.
It just seems absolutely mad that they classed him as a low-risk prisoner. I mean, he literally raped a woman and, what, stabbed somebody in the face? Back to Wednesday, January the 12th, 1977. Having been assessed as a low-risk prisoner, Hughes was transferred via taxi with 2 prison guards from Leicester Prison to Chesterfield Magistrates Court.
I mean, in itself, you know, is that still a thing? I mean,
I hope not.
I mean, is it just like a normal?
It's bizarre.
Mini cab? Is it one of the ones with a screen across? You know, across or?
And really, using the taxi as a transfer has been described as an, in quotes, madness by Chief Inspector Peter House of Derbyshire Constabulary. So it's not just us that thinks it's absolutely ridiculous.
So at Leicester Prison, I mean, I've driven by Leicester Prison before, and it looks, like a lot of prisons, it looks effing grim. So he presumably, as a Category C prisoner, he had quite a bit of freedom. Maybe he was certainly trusted to work as a kitchen assistant with full access to whatever's in a kitchen, so knives. So unbeknown to anyone at the time, obviously, he'd managed to secrete a knife that he presumably got from the kitchen during his kitchen assistant duties. And during the transfer, he stabbed both prison officers in the neck, which kind of leads to the sort of obvious question is, was he searched? I mean, he would have had to leave the Leicester prison. He'd had to go out the kitchen when he was working there, prison, into the taxi, yet he wasn't. I mean, God knows where he had this knife secreted.
Strange. I wonder what he was actually like in prison.
Well, there's very little, from what we can, you know, easily accessible at least, information. Who knows? I mean, presumably transferring him via taxi is indicative that they didn't see him as, you know, a risk, as we've said.
And maybe he was quite manipulative.
Maybe.
If he is kind of verging on more of a kind of a psychopathic trait.
Maybe.
People like that can be quite manipulative and can make friends really, you know, quite easily. And friends for the right reasons, really. So
maybe. I mean, I did read somewhere that when he was living in Chesterfield before the alleged offence, let's say, for the rape at knife point and stabbing someone in the head, that he, you know, he's a regular drinker in, I think it's the area of Brampton in Chesterfield, and by all accounts, he was sort of, you know, reasonably sociable.
Sounds like a really nice guy.
Well, we'll see. But so he managed to hijack this taxi, got the taxi driver. He was just a normal everyday taxi driver. He wasn't employed by the prison service. So he got him out and he got the prison officers out. And then he kind of drove off and then eventually crashed it, which will be a kind of a theme as we'll see. A
reoccurring theme.
Yeah, yeah. So then, so if you can imagine the scene, so it's a place called Beelymore near Chesterfield. So he ran, jogged, he walked several hours through, you know, the driving snow over Beelymore. And as I said earlier, it literally is the middle of nowhere. And you wouldn't want to be running out of petrol, you know, on there, whether Billy Hughes is around there or not. So we came across Pottery Cottage. At one end of the three cottages lived Mr. and Mrs. Minton. So Arthur, 72, and his wife, Amy, of a similar age. Not sure the age, but it doesn't really matter. Also living there was their 38-year-old daughter, Jill Moran, and her husband, 36-year-old Richard.
We've had a disagreement about how you say that last name. I'm Irish, I say Moran, but Neil seems to think it's Moran.
Yeah, I mean...
But hey-ho.
Yeah. So, middle cottage was empty, and then at the other end were two teachers, Mr. and Mrs. Newman. Richard, he was a sales director of a plastics company in sort of the Chesterfield area, which is still in business today, I believe. Jill was a secretary in Chesterfield. Their daughter, Sarah, who was age 10, also lived with them.
On arrival at Pottery Cottage, Hughes noticed a couple of axes outside that the family used for chopping wood. He crept into Arthur and Amy Minton's cottage. Amy was preparing dinner for the family at this time. Amy turned around to see Hughes with an axe in his hand, and Hughes quickly reacted and took a 5-inch boning knife from the kitchen drawer and placed it in his pocket.
You know, that's like your worst nightmare, isn't it? Turning around and there's a strange, menacing bloke there with an axe in each hand.
And he is massive as well. And if you, like, I mean, we've had a look at his, you know, pictures.
Mm.
He is a scary looking bloke. He really is.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. Well, ooh. I mean, I suppose most people would really, wouldn't they, with an axe in each hand? A strange man in your house.
Mm.
So we're not sure exactly how, but Amy and Arthur, you know, they're in the 70s. Mad bloke turns up with an axe in each hand. Probably kind of, you know, appeared quite intimidating. So Jill, she arrived back from work about 3 p.m. She finished at 3 because daughter was at school. She wanted to be at home for daughter when she got back from school. So she arrived in her Hillman Imp. If you're Googling it, Hillman Imp, my dad used to have one of these, apparently, before I was born. That's by the by. So, so Jill arrived back. So she came into the house, and then her mum, Amy, said, this here, you know, this mad fucker here is a man on the run. He's got a knife, but he's promised not to harm us. And then Hughes said something to the effect of, you know, I've stabbed two prison officers. I didn't kill them. But I know how to kill. Sarah then turned up from school, got dropped off outside, presumably the school bus. Must have been outside, because as I say, it's middle of nowhere, she's only 10. So obviously she got in the arse and thought, you know, who's this chap? Jill just said, oh, it's just somebody that's broke down in the car, and just said, oh, you know, go and play in your room. So Richard, so he came back at 5 p.m. and I mean, you just can't imagine this. He was greeted, so he'd come through his front door, you know, day at work, pleased to get home, with the sight of Hughes having a knife to his wife's throat. God only knows what Richard thought about that. He got a flex from a lamp and a washing line to bind the hands and feet of all of them. Arthur, so he's 72, he was angry and he kind of tried to resist, and he told Hughes to get out my ass. First bit of violence here from Hughes. He pushed Arthur to the floor. Arthur struggled to get back up with great difficulty. He had a prosthetic leg.
He's bloody 70 years old.
He's 70 years old. And he's you know, good on him. So they're all then gagged as well. So without difficulty then, Hughes lifted Richard, who I think he says somewhere he was 12 stone, so, you know, fully grown man. And seen a picture of Richard, and he's no, you know, he's not like a particularly small man. So Hughes lifted him on his shoulder, over his shoulder, up the stairs, into a room. He did the same then with Amy and with Jill. So they're all in different room upstairs. The only person downstairs at this point is Arthur. He was bound and gagged in his armchair in the lounge.
So the situation continued throughout the night until the next day. So the next day, Thursday the 13th of January, a man came actually to empty the septic tank. Jill signed for the job that it was done, and the man that came to do the job didn't really see any signs of any issues, so off he went. Shortly after this, Hughes instructed Jill to ring in sick for her workplace and also to ring Sarah's school explaining that she is ill and won't make it in today.
So having rung up Sarah's school and Jill's work, Hughes then orders Jill to drive into Chesterfield for cigarettes and a newspaper. Although, you know, Jill's going off on her own, he said, don't do anything silly because I've got your family here. Before she went, Jill wanted to know if, can I see Sarah? Can I check she's okay? Hughes said, well, she's okay, but you can't see her now. And we spoke about this, didn't we? We said kind of, you know, you can't imagine, can you? But what would we do if you got kind of free rein to kind of go, you know, you're on your own in the car. What would you do? You know, would you go to the police? Would you tell them? Or would you just think, well, so far Hughes has only, yeah, he's pushed Arthur to the floor, but he's not, as far as we know, he's not been violent as yet.
Because it's Jill and Richard that go out on their own to get this stuff from the shop.
I think this is just Jill on her own at this
Jill
point.
Jill on her own.
But either, you know.
So it's Jill on her own going to the shop.
Obviously at home you've got daughter.
Yeah, but
husband, mum and dad.
I struggle with that because I would go to the police, but then again, I haven't been in this situation.
Well,
it's hard to make a judgment.
I mean, yeah, it's very, and it's one of them things, isn't it? It's whatever you choose, you've got to go with, haven't you, there and then. You know, you haven't got kind of three options, see how they all play out. You just got to go with it there and then and decide. And Jill obviously thought,
well, adrenaline takes over sometimes.
Well, she obviously, you know, she probably thought like, well, you know, I don't know.
Just keep him sweet, he'll bugger off.
Yeah, and he'll fuck off and, you know, and then you can get the police.
Yeah.
It's very easy to criticise, isn't it? So, she eventually returned, and then, about 9:30 that evening, Hughes then told Richard to ring in sick at work. Hughes then, I mean, this is it's quite sort of,
things just take a bit of a bizarre turn.
Well, he untied Richard, Amy, and Jill, and he asked Jill to you know, can you make some toast and tea, which obviously she did. They actually played cards, read the papers, and I mean, it's a weird thing to say, but it's kind of like a relaxing evening. I mean, God knows what they, you know, what they were thinking. Probably just, you know, keep him sweet, you know.
Possibly the most awkward game of cards ever, though.
Well, it's just,
you'd want to make sure he wins.
He wins, yeah. Yeah. Richard had a Chrysler 180. Now, no idea what this car was, so I had to Google it. And really, the thing that I would describe it is if it was kind of like a 1970s version of a, I don't know, like a businessman's or like a rep's Ford Mondeo equivalent sort of thing. And yeah, so Hughes wanted to go out for a test drive in it. So Hughes, Richard and Amy,
off they go,
went out in the car. And then Hughes announced that he wanted to go and see a friend in Sutton in Ashfield, which is approximately about probably 20 miles away, something like that. And he said he needed to give this friend, this mate, proceeds from a past robbery that they'd done together. They never actually got there. They called in at somewhere called Roy's Calf, which is Was that the cafe from Coronation Street? Was that Roy's Rolls? God knows. I don't know. I don't watch it. My mum does.
It just sounds a bit odd. It's almost like he's playing mind games with them. I don't know if he's playing mind games
or is he just kind of doing it. He's just making it up as he goes. That's our thing.
Is he buying time? Is he playing mind games? What is it all about?
I don't know. I mean, what's he pissing around going all the way there and back? I mean,
no
surely...
one wants to go to Sutton either, to be honest. Nothing good has ever happened in Sutton.
Well, a bit harsh. It's like anywhere, isn't it? Good and bad parts. But the thing is, you know, surely he's going to know by now that these prison officers, you know, that he's not arrived at Chesterfield Magistrates Court. They're expecting this prisoner arriving with two prison officers in a taxi. This is like a day and a half fucking after.
So strange.
So what's he pissing around going like? I mean, it must be an hour, innit?
And so actually kind of risky because he's bad. Like faffing around.
I think he's just...
Does he even give a fuck? Like, is he just like...
I don't think he knows what he's doing. You know, not. I don't mean like he's necessarily insane or anything. I think he knows what he's...
He just didn't have a plan, maybe.
No. I think he's just like... I think he's just kind of... I mean, whether there ever was a person in Sutton in Ashfield who we did a bank job with, God, I mean, who knows? God knows. Maybe there was. I mean...
Maybe it was Roy from the cafe.
It could be. And then there's like a bizarre bit where they got to this Roy's calf. I mean, God, I don't know where that... I don't even know if it's still standing, but they get to Roy's calf in this, and they get to like the car park bit, and he takes the keys out of the ignition, and he go and Hughes goes into this calf, right? This is God's honest truth, what it says. So he's in this calf, he goes into this calf and says to him, you know, don't move, like, obviously, so they don't move, they're just there. Well, they haven't got the key anyway, so they can't. And it comes out, Hughes does eventually, some time after, with a policeman's truncheon. Now, that is what it says. I mean, I don't know whether that... What, did he assault a policeman or did he just... Did Roy have a policeman's truncheon or something?
Something really fishy about that.
Did he find it in the toilet or what? Maybe sell them. I don't know. But seriously, that's what it says. But anyway. So, they do this excursion to Sutton in Ashfield, which, you know, for the evening out. Nice drive out. And then, at some time later, probably an hour and a half later or something, they return back to Pottery Cottage. So they've kind of done like a tour of, you know, Derbyshire into Nottinghamshire. Now they're back at Pottery Cottage. What he wants to do now, so Sarah's in her own room. Arthur is in a separate room downstairs, tied up in his armchair. And they want Amy, Jill and Richard together in one room. So he can, in his words, keep an eye on him.
So at some stage in the evening, Hughes told Richard and Jill that he needed some shopping. He mentioned that he needed soup, a camping stove and gas, steak and lamb chops, cigarettes and sweets. And he also said quite strangely at the time, can you please bring back a present for Sarah? So off Richard and Jill went and completed this task and returned home. Surely these two will drive somewhere and flag for some help.
Obviously, their main concern, as well as the mum and dad, would have been Sarah, the daughter. But with Hughes saying, you know, bring something back for Sarah, you know, that's going to kind of... Not that he's a good chap, he's a good fella, but that, oh, well, you know, that's sort of...
Sarah's okay, she's safe.
Well, yeah, you know, not...
And
well,
he's thinking of her.
Well, yeah, to some degree, yeah.
It just strikes me as very bizarre, though.
It is, but it's like anything in hindsight, though, isn't it? It's you know, it's always... I mean, when you're in it, I mean, are you thinking clearly anyway? I mean, it's just, fuck it, you can't...
It's madness.
Yeah.
So they actually brought back an Enid Blyton book for Sarah, and they also brought back the newspaper, which Hughes himself on the front page.
So I bet they would have, you know, they would have read that on the way back, wouldn't they? And it would have And it would have said, like, you know, that he stabbed this... Well, they know that, don't they? But, you know... stabbed the two prison officers, and also probably a bit about in the the past and convictions.
But all the more reason to seek help while they had the chance.
Well, yeah, but then all the more reason to get back to make sure that... No, I mean, I know what you're saying. You know, if they could replay this again, I'm sure... Well, I don't know. Maybe they would have done that, but, you know, they're keeping him... They're trying to keep him sweet, aren't they?
Keeping him sweet.
Well, that's... Can you do, isn't it?
So they return back, have the newspaper, Hughes himself on the front page. But his travel excursion has not yet finished. At about 7 p.m, Hughes decided he needs money for his next journey. He ordered Richard to go to his workplace at Brett Plastics to find some cash.
I think it was Richard and Hughes went, I think. I've read conflicting reports here. I don't, because if Hughes went, then obviously the people back at the home would be...
I bet you that he tied them up again.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, well, anyway. So Richard arrived about 7 p.m. and the night shift had already started, apparently. So, Christ, you know, it's a bit of an early night shift, isn't it? But anyway, so there was quite a few people around. And Richard went to his office, and I don't know, petty cash or whatever. He found 210 quid, which equates to roughly about £600 in today's money. So, that excursion was over, then back to Pottery Cottage. And then after all these events, staff, you know, saw Richard going into work on that, you know, on that night, you know, looking for the money, and they didn't suspect anything. You know, Richard just acted, I think he just said he had a bit of work to finish off, and they didn't suspect anything, you know. It was only afterwards, obviously, when they kind of found out. Hughes wanted his shopping that they got on the earlier excursion put into Richard's Chrysler with Jill. Jill and... He wanted Jill with him. I mean, whether, you know, that was as potential hostage, whether that was for Richard to use her to rape her, maybe. He's got on a...
Or to ride off into the sunset.
With her? Yeah. Sort of new, I don't know. I mean, it's... But anyway, so they kind of get in the car... And then Hughes, you know, oh, forgot the road atlas. Obviously, in those days, on a Chrysler 180, you know.
No Google Maps.
Or sat-nav. Although sat-nav's a bit outdated now, isn't it? You just use your phone.
Yeah, it's Google Maps now.
Yeah, it's Google Maps, isn't it? And,
showing your age.
Still a young lad. So then Hughes then said, oh, I'll go and get the road atlas. I want to check on Sarah, Arthur. You know, Jill's in the car. Thinking, fucking hell, you know. But again, she's flipping miles from anywhere, really. Middle of nowhere. Eventually, Hughes comes back to the car, tries to start the car. Car won't start.
Eesh. So
he's like, obviously, you know, well, obviously, but he's fucking very angry. Tells Jill, go and get the neighbours. Go and see if they can. I mean, that shows the balls of this man as well, doesn't it?
I don't think he gives a fuck, to be honest.
Well...
Or else he's just an idiot. Or, I don't know.
I don't know.
He's either so ballsy that he doesn't give a shit, or he's just plain stupid.
Depends how you find stupid, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, he's done so many risky things.
I mean, he spent half his... How old is he? 30? He spent roughly half his life... In jail, perhaps jail doesn't particularly hold much fucking... Do you know what I mean? I mean, for me, the thought of being in jail would be...
It's probably nothing to him.
Well, yeah, it's probably not that. So he's probably just taking it as far as he can. I don't know. So the neighbours who live next but one in the other end of this kind of row of cottages, one of the neighbours kind of comes out to the car. Jill managed to kind of silently mouth, there's some kind of problem here. They presumably not bought paper. Obviously there's no internet, it's 1977.
What, no internet?
No, there's no internet. So they didn't know, you know, they didn't know about it. And they live in the middle of nowhere, and they didn't even have a landline, well, and obviously no mobile phone. And they're living in, you know, it's literally the middle of nowhere, this, you know, where they live in. So they didn't know about that there was a man on the run. So the neighbours are thinking, what's some kind of problem, but I don't know what. You know, they would have obviously seen this stranger in Richard's car, you know, Hughes, but, you know, they didn't really know what was kind of going on. Jill's mum, she'd actually, she was tied up, bound and gagged, and unbeknown to Jill at that time, Hughes, when he'd gone back in to apparently check on them, he'd slit her throat. She managed to get out the first floor window, so she, like we said earlier, she was upstairs, fell from the first floor window, you know, which in itself, and you know, this lady's in her 70s, it's not good whatever age you are.
It's awful.
So they're in the car, I mean, you know, Jill's in the car with Hughes, and then Amy, her mother, appears at the windscreen, heavily bleeding, and then promptly collapses dead. in the driveway, which must have been absolutely terrifying.
And this was her first encounter then with death. Until here, things were kind of okay. Yeah, she was being smuggled away in a car.
Psychologically,
but, you know, to anyone's knowledge, no one had died yet.
No, but she definitely knew, you know, then.
Yeah.
And she...
Things had taken a turn.
Well, it's yeah. I mean, her mum, you know, to try and... I mean, she would have known that she was going to fall out the window, but she was doing all she could to try and make Jill, the neighbours, trying
aware.
To alert them, which...
Oh, bless her.
Which, you know, I mean, yeah, you know, she died, but that's recorded forever, you know, for what it's worth, forevermore, isn't it, that she tried to do that?
Yeah. So he's heading towards Baslow. Jill is still hostage with Hughes at this time in the car. And this was just about 8:30 in the evening time. So at this stage, Jill had not seen her daughter in a couple of days because they'd all been separated and had just seen her mum collapse dead in front of her. A short time after, police arrived at Pottery Cottage to find Richard, Amy, Arthur and 10-year-old Sarah murdered. Obviously, Jill was still unaware that her whole family had just been murdered. She was in the car.
Well, she just knew about her mother, of course, which is... in itself.
Yeah.
But she didn't know about the other three.
Hughes drove at dangerous speeds with, unknown to him at the time, an unmarked police car in pursuit. Whether he realised after a while, it's not quite clear. However, he did eventually crash into a wall.
Again.
The two police officers ran straight away up to Hughes's car. And Hughes actually raised an axe above Jill's head and shouted, "Back off or I'll kill her." Jill was then dragged out with Hughes, demanding that the police hand over their car, a Morris Mariner. So Hughes set off in this police car with Jill towards Whaley Bridge. And eventually at around 10 p.m. he came upon a police roadblock. I think they used a bus to block the road. He tried to avoid the bus, but again crashed into another wall. Armed police were on the scene, however... They couldn't get a clear shot, unfortunately, at the time.
Started in negotiations with Hughes for about 1.5 hours. Hughes was demanding rite of passage and another car. Eventually, Hughes kind of announced, "Time's up." Then he raised the axe above Jill. At that time, it was shot in the head. And he still continued to move at this stage. Then he was shot through the window. Through the car window, twice in his body and another in the heart, which was the end of Billy Hughes. Jill, physically at least, aside from a bit of kind of superficial wounds from the flying, you know, glass.
And the several car
crashes
into walls.
She was physically okay. I mean, obviously, psychologically is another issue. Shortly after this, Jill was told that not only a mum that she was aware of, but a dad, her husband and a daughter were all dead. Arthur was killed the first evening. Now, where the lounge is, where his kind of favourite armchair is, there's like a glass, or there was a glass door from there to the kind of rest of the house. And Jill presumed Arthur was, yeah, she knew he was bound and gagged, but she could see him in this chair through the glass. So she presumed, you know, he was okay. So he was killed the first evening. Sarah was killed when Jill was sent off on the first trip to Chesterfield for the cigarettes and the newspaper. And then before they set off on this mad escape, I think, or it said that when he went back to check for the road atlas, to get the road atlas and to when Hugh said he was going to check on them, that's when he killed Richard and Amy by cutting the throat. And as we already said, Amy, you know, really bravely attempted to give some kind of warning. She'd had a throat cut and she fell out the window and God knows how, but she managed to get down the drive and get to the car.
I think one of the saddest parts is, you know, looking back, Richard and Jill went out to get this Enid Blyton book
for
the daughter. She had already sadly passed away.
Yeah, it's
there's something just really, really poignant and sad about that, I think.
Yeah, because they you know, being the mum and dad, they obviously knew, you know, that she liked Enid Blyton books. So they would have thought, oh, what, you know.
And they had no idea, really.
What's going to, what might cheer her up a little bit, you know, because obviously they would, they would know that, that Sarah's very distressed, you know, at this time. I mean, you know, with the title of the podcast, I mean, we spoke about this, haven't we? You know, mad or, was he mad or was he bad or?
And it's really hard to come to a conclusion, actually. There's pretty much no information regarding Hughes's upbringing or his childhood.
Other than that, from, what was he, first offence at 14?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there was something going on. That's not the norm. But we don't know what that was. So as I said, it's pretty impossible to make a conclusion as to, you know, whether he did have mental health problems, whether he had trauma in his childhood, and what really led to him offending in such a way.
I mean, you know, I think as we've said, you know, we are mental health nurses. We're not in no way trying to make any excuses for him, but it. Because we don't know if he did have a mental illness, but
there is a reason that people become like this. We just don't know what that reason was. You know, there is some psychiatrists who commented that he was, you know, an explosive psychopath. However, we're not really sure whether that's in hindsight, looking back on, you know, what happened.
Was he someone that treated him? Did Hughes have
or is it just comment?
Is it just bad luck? Yeah, or was he just, you know, a bad person?
Yeah,
a bad person. Not mentally ill. Was he a bad person? I mean, we're never gonna know. I mean,
I think it's interesting though that when he was in jail, he spent hours and hours doting over his daughter, making her toys with matchsticks.
Apparently, he's in some reports says he was a estranged wife, Jean, I think her name, or some ex-wife. But anyway, that's by the by. But yeah, apparently he when he wasn't in prison, he doted on the daughter, you know. But then to have, I'm not sure how old the daughter was. I read somewhere that it was 10, so similar-ish. Age.
Well, that's the exact same age.
Yeah, I'm.
And to go and kill a 10-year-old girl is.
To kill anyone, of course, you know, baffles me. We don't know, and that's not like a get at. We're not trying to kind of, you know, I mean, we don't know.
We don't know.
Was he mad or bad? There's no point saying because, he certainly.
But he certainly ticks some of the boxes. I mean, when you look at psychopathy, you know, it's characterised as a personality disorder with, you know, persistent antisocial behaviour, impaired empathy, you know, impaired remorse, that kind of disinhibited, you know, bold.
Well, he was able to kind of carry on after killing Sarah and then sending them out for a book for a present for Sarah.
To me that sounds like mind games though, and it's
I don't
it's
know
bizarre.
It's hard to say. I think he was, I mean, he would have known the area roughly because he was living in Chesterfield and the moors where the Pottery Cottage is, you know. He might not have, I don't think he'd probably known where Pottery Cottage was, but he would have roughly known where he was because he'd been living, although he was from Preston in Lancashire, he had been living in Chesterfield, which, as we've said, is, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 miles from Pottery Cottage. So he would have roughly known where he was. But it was at night, it was a snowstorm. So I think he just kind of made it up as he went along in terms of, I don't think it was a plan, you know, I'm going to, this Pottery Cottage is up that way. I think it was a plan, obviously, on the moors where no one's about, that he would ambush them then.
He just, you know, went with the opportunity, really.
I mean, well, you know, you talked about psychopathy. I mean, personality disorder, I mean, as we know, I mean, it's a fairly recent
term,
diagnosis. But that's not to say that people presenting with those set of symptoms that make a diagnosis, that's not to say that people didn't have a personality disorder before. But as we know, a diagnosis really I mean, I think we both think this, Rachel, don't we? A diagnosis is only really useful. Well, it's a set of symptoms that equate to a set of treatments.
Yeah, but obviously. Well, not obviously, but with personality disorders, I mean, when you look at the literature, there isn't really an agreed treatment as such, especially with things like, you know, antisocial behaviour and stuff. It's not clear cut.
But again, like we've said, we can't say, you know, he might have just been a bad...
A really bad person.
A bad bastard.
A really bad bastard.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, these four innocent people died. But Jill did get married a couple of years after to actually Richard's cousin.
Keep it in the family.
Well, they looked quite similar, actually, but it's Richard's cousin. I guess there's going to be some family resemblance, but that's by the by. But and they had a daughter, actually, at some time after. And Jill's husband, he was actually jailed, I think, 1988. He threatened a pub landlord with a shotgun, which must have brought back horrendous memories for Jill.
But she's never spoken publicly about the murders.
No, and I don't blame her for that.
And conceivably, she may still be alive, and if she...
I hope so, yeah.
If she is alive and doing well, then so. She'd possibly be around 80 years old.
She'd be about 80 and good on her. I hope she is, and she's got a daughter as well. I don't know if she's still married, but hopefully she's doing it. Doing well. But just as a last ironic sort of point, really, when Hughes was killed, his ex-wife or estranged wife wanted Hughes to be taken back to Blackpool, buried in Blackpool, where she was living. Now he was going to be, it was buried, a burial by state, so state were paying and they wouldn't foot the bill for transport to Blackpool. So then it was, is he going to be buried in Chesterfield? So more local to where he was living and obviously where he was killed. There were lots of local protests. Certain churches had the, you know, doors, no, not the doors, the gates to the cemeteries padlocked. And ironically, he was actually cremated at the same crematorium as the family that he murdered. And I believe that his ashes were given to his wife, and I don't know.
Yeah, so, I wonder what she did with them.
But anyway, thank you all for listening. We hope that, I'm going to say enjoyed. We don't enjoy people, kind of, we just find it interesting.
We don't enjoy the murders, but we enjoy discussing the murders.
We enjoy discussing it, and if one person enjoys it, then... Yay. We're happy. If no one enjoys it, we're still happy because we enjoy doing it. So see you next time.
See you next time.